Welcome to the Karen Conti Show on 720 WGN.
Good evening, everyone, and happy Mother's Day to everybody out there. Happy Mother's Day to the mothers, to the grandmothers, great-grandmothers, stepmothers, mothers who father, and fathers who mother. There's all kinds of variations of being a mother, and I want to wish you all a very happy Mother's Day. I hope you were taken out to dinner or received flowers or at least a phone call. At least a phone call. That is the very minimum. But I want to talk about a sad kind of mother's case to begin with, and then we'll pick it up and we're going to talk about favoritism and do mothers have favorites? And you as a child, adult child, did your mother have a favorite and did that affect you? And I'm looking forward to hearing your comments on that, 981-7200. But before we start that, I want to talk. I was a little disturbed, as I think most people were this week. There was that horrible case of the newborn who was abandoned in the alley here in Chicago. The story started out that a woman walked into a firehouse. She said she found a newborn infant and in an alley, and she was giving it to the firehouse under the safe haven law. Turns out that this wasn't quite the case, that the woman was a 37-year-old grandmother, and she was the grandmother of this newborn. And apparently, her son's girlfriend, they were 16 and 17 years old, she had no idea, apparently, that the 16-year-old was pregnant, and she gave birth. The story is that they both thought the child was dead. They put the child in a bag. The mother was called. The mother came over and picked them both up. She heard a noise and realized the child was still alive and went over to the firehouse and delivered the baby. The baby is in serious condition, may have some issues because of deprivation of air, but we're all hoping that child is going to pull through and be fine. The question here is, of course, the children were charged. They were charged with attempted murder, and they were charged as juveniles, which would probably be a little bit of a lighter sentence, of course. But the grandmother who had really no peace in this other than she lied to the police and to the fire department. And she lied, and that's what we call disorderly conduct. Interestingly, lying to a police officer, as we probably all know from the Jussie Smollett case, there's no such crime in Illinois called lying to a police officer. It's really disorderly conduct. It falls in that catch-all. And I'm wondering, does that offend anybody here this is a woman who didn't know what was going on. She heard the baby cry. She did the right thing. She rushed the child to somewhere as fast as she could to get it help. And she lied about it because she was protecting her son and her son's girlfriend and didn't tell the truth. I don't know. Does anyone feel strongly about that? 981-7200, 981-7200. It sounds like a tragedy all the way around. These children were young, but yet I think people should know that they have other options here. And just in case you don't know, in a case you want to tell people in your area, that the Illinois Safe Haven Law is a wonderful law. It allows parents to anonymously relinquish an unharmed newborn up to 30 days old to a staff member at a hospital, police station, fire department, or anywhere that's been designated as a safe haven. Usually there's a sign on the building in a very conspicuous place that tells you it's a safe haven. That person can remain anonymous. You can give medical information to the people if you want, if that's important to you. And you can stay and you can get free counseling. They can recommend counseling for you. And after 60 days, the Department of Public Health then can petition to have the child sever all relationship with the biological parents and then move toward either adoption, foster parenting, or some other option. So I think people should know about that. I think it's something that is designed clearly to make sure that people who have children and don't want them have a place to take them where they will be cared for and you will not be called upon to enter that child's life unless you want to. And a lot of people, after they drop off children, they do have a second thought, and they go back and they try to get parental rights, and that's something that's certainly possible. But 981-7200, if anybody has any comments on that, or am I wrong? Does the grandmother have some culpability here because she lied? I want to talk, I'm going to switch gears now to something a little lighter, but maybe not so light. I wanted to talk about a topic of favoritism. And, you know, when you're a mother and your kids ask you, you know, which one of us is your favorite, mom always says, I love you all the exact same way, but that's not always the case. In fact, there have been books written and studies done about favoritism, and the majority of parents, if telling the truth, will say that they do, in fact, have a favorite child. Now, whether that parent acts on it or not, they do have preferences, generally speaking, and that can be a preference because maybe your little girl is important to you because you're a woman and you bonded better with a female, or maybe that firstborn was always special because it was firstborn and you had that child first. Sometimes it's the last one. In fact, the statistics show that overall firstborns get more privileges, but the lastborns get more parental affection. So that maybe by the time that last child is born, you're all love and less discipline, which is the case, I think, in my family. But anyway, the idea of favoritism in families can have devastating effects. And the studies show that if you are an unfavored or a disfavored child, that is harder on you than it's good to be a favored child, meaning the impact of a bad being disfavored is more dramatic and more traumatic long term for purposes of depression, drugs, negative feelings, lack of self-esteem, resentments, bitterness, not good relationships with significant others. All of those kinds of things can spill into your, not only your childhood, but into your adulthood. A woman who did a massive study on this, and her name is Ellen Libby Weber Libby. She's written several books and she speaks about it. You can catch her on the web. She has done a study and she says that every president since Franklin Roosevelt has been a favored child. And I don't know how exactly she did that study. I think she probably asked certain people and went back and tried to do some research. But for what it's worth, that's a very interesting statement, meaning that the favored child did well. Now, it could be that when you're president of the United States and you're hotshot in the military, or you've gone to law school, or you've succeeded at some point monetarily, that maybe, you know, you've always been a good kid and that's why you were easy to like and that's why your mom liked you best. I don't know. I don't know. It's like cause and effect. But I'd like to hear from you. What are you a favorite child? Moms out there, you don't have to say your name or give me a fake name, because I want to know, if you have a favorite child, is that hard on you? Do you try to be fair? Or do some children just make it hard for you to like them? I mean, you love your children, but not all of them you like as much. You don't want to be around them as much. I've seen that in my family. 981-7200, 312-981-7200. We'll take a break and we'll come back. This is the Karen Conti Show. Mother's Day. We're talking about a couple things. We're talking about being a favorite child, and I want to hear your comments on that, 981-7200. But I'm also talking about the sad case of the grandmother who brought the abandoned child in to the firehouse. Turned out it was her son and the son's girlfriend's child. They thought the child had was deceased. The child was alive. The mother lied to the fire department and said that she found the child when, in fact, she knew it was her son and her girlfriend's. And she's being charged, and I want to know, is that fair? Is it fair that she's being charged for lying to the fire department? Greg from Wheeling, you want to weigh in on this. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good, Greg.
I was always under the impression that when somebody drops a baby off like that, that it's no questions asked. Do you know the rule on that?
Well, I don't, you know, that's a really interesting point, because it's an Illinois safe haven law says that you can anonymously drop the child off. But, you know, here's the situation. The law says that it has to be an unharmed child. My guess is going to be that there's going to be exceptions to that rule when there's a lie. You know, when you come in and say, I found the child, as opposed to this is my child and I'm turning the child in, that probably takes it out of the safe haven. Haven-Law is my guess. And then the second thing is the child really wasn't doing very well, and we don't know if it's because it wasn't given medical treatment right away or what it was, what happened. But that would also take it out of the law. But you're absolutely right. No questions asked, but they must have asked questions, and she must have volunteered that information. And I suppose the third part is if you volunteer the information and it's false, that also takes it out of the safe haven law. It's a great question, because this sort of says to people, maybe I shouldn't use the safe haven law, and maybe I'm not going to be okay if I bring some child in here. And I think it sets a bad example, doesn't it?
Well, I think it's going to set a bad precedent. Like, people are going to see this and think, oh, boy, look at what happened to her. I'm not going to do that. And then people are going to dump more babies in alleys.
Well, and particularly because she was a grandparent. I mean, she was protecting her son and his girlfriend, which is kind of a natural thing to do. And maybe it wasn't the best decision in the whole wide world, but it was the decision she made at the moment. And I just can't fault her for it. I just can't.
I mean, I know it's a whole terrible situation, but like I said, if it's supposed to be no questions asked, then that's the way it should be. Just drop the baby off and be done with it. But instead, she's getting raked over the coals for trying to do the right thing.
And especially because we watched the Jussie Smollett case play out, where he was charged with disorderly conduct for lying to the police numerous times. All of those charges were dropped, miraculously. And I'm just thinking, you know, in the fairness of the world, what Jussie Smollett did and what this grandmother did have nothing in common at all.
Right, yeah.
And certainly maybe there will be some dropping of the charge, and I hope that's the case, and I hope she gets a lawyer who makes that happen for her, because I think that's the right verdict. Greg, thank you so much for your call. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, take care. Also, I have a texter who said that it's another issue. I know for a fact this topic of safe haven is taught in sex ed in most high schools due to the increasing young mothers giving birth. And that's good. I would expect that would be something that would be taught. Schools probably don't put enough focus. It takes 9 months for a child to be born. Therefore, there were 9 months to decide this child's fate. And that's a good point. I mean, you know, in prosecuting these two young people, I assume that's one of the arguments, is that this wasn't something that happened. I mean, occasionally you see a girl give birth who doesn't know she's pregnant, and that happens. It doesn't happen very often, but I know for a fact it does happen. I don't know if this was the case here. The texter goes on to say, I think they're all responsible and should be held accountable. The grandmother's 37. She's not a child and should have had some compassion. After all, it is her grandchildren. Her grandchild. And, you know, I agree with you but just the decision she made. Here's the child my son and his girlfriend had and left in, you know, in an alley. I picked this child up, you know, my child now. I mean, these kids are, I mean, I'm calling them children. They're young adults. They're being charged with a very serious crime, which could impact them the rest of their lives. I just think it was probably the natural thing for a mother to do, whether it's right or wrong. I think the maternal instinct is something that is very strong. But thank you for your comments. We'll watch that one and see how it plays out. Let's talk about favoritism. It was this topic that I'm kind of dwelling on tonight. Being a favorite child can have ramifications long term. And if you're a disfavored child, it can have really bad ramifications long term. So most parents, they say, do have a preference when it comes to their children for one reason or another, birth order, the gender, time of life. I think sometimes when parents are going through trauma, whether it's a marital discord, financial issues, it's harder to connect and bond and to do those things that a parent needs to do. But I guess I want to talk to everybody, 981-7200. Does anyone want to talk about being a favored child or favoring one of your children? I know, Jerry, you're one of two, and both your parents are deceased, so now you can speak honestly. Were you a favorite child?
I definitely was a favorite child, and rightfully so.
And modest about it.
The hard part for me was that it was painfully obvious to me as I got older that I was the favorite child, and my brother was not. And I tend to think as he got older, he really had no familial loyalty. He just wanted to move on. He got married, moved on, and really wanted no part of the family. Now, was it his fault? Well, when he was born, my father was at World War II, and they really never bonded. And then my brother who was raised by women as a very at a very young boy. It was very girly, very. He was kind of a crybaby, and
Jerry, really?
I was wonderful. I was just cool from the second I was born. My dad was embarrassingly showed favoritism to me
because you played sports. You were like you did a little bit more of the, yeah, the guy thing with him, yeah.
And was 7 years later, so my parents were doing much better financially. So I got things my brother never got, like a car. Yeah, and I think it was a problem.
I think those resentments, and Roger, you know, pipe in if you want. I was one of three. I was a middle child, and actually middle children are the ones who don't get really much of any of the good stuff. The child gets all the attention and all of the leeway because they're older, and then the last one gets the affection and gets, you know, gets a lot of like, oh, we're not gonna enforce that curfew anymore because it didn't matter for the other kids. But I don't know. I think I was my dad's favorite, but he was really good at not showing that. I just know that he and I bonded. Just we had the same kind of personality and the same sort of sense of humor. And then when you get older, I took care of him. I was the one who was there for him. I was there in proximity with him. I was the one who made sure he was okay. And clearly that is something that I think, you know, made me his favorite. My mother had other favorites. I think my mother favored my brother and my younger sister in different ways, maybe because I think she not was jealous of me. It wasn't that. It was just we butted heads because we were alike in certain ways. Roger, yeah. What about you?
Well, my older brother, my firstborn, or the firstborn, so much was expected of him, especially academically. Not necessarily along sports lines or anything out of the classroom, and he excelled at it. My sister, the middleborn, was kind of dad's favorite. Mom and her did more battles, but dad always favored her over both of the boys. Even though I was the last in line and the youngest, I kind of was not really planned.
Okay.
And in general, I was kind of left to my own devices.
Which is not a bad thing.
Except that no matter which device I chose, it was always the wrong one as far as my dad was concerned.
Well, Roger, I think we need to talk about this further, but I think you have to lie down on the couch in the green room.
I think so.
Yeah, I think so, too. When we come back, actually, today is not only Mother's Day, but it's National Limerick Day, and I will have a limerick for you when I give it to news. This is Karen Conti on WGN. The most dangerous place for a woman is where? Where do you think?
The what place?
The most dangerous place for a woman.
It's
the home. Some call it domestic violence. Some call it private violence. Our guest tonight calls it intimate terrorism. In whatever terms we use, please know that the World Health Organization deems this issue to be a global epidemic. Our guest tonight is an award-winning journalist, Rachel Louise Snyder, author of the much-praised book, No Visible Bruises. Professor Snyder is an associate professor at American University in Washington. Her work has been published in The New Yorker, Time Magazine, The Washington Post, and she's written several books, fiction and nonfiction. Welcome to the show, Professor. Thank you for joining me on Mother's Day.
Oh, thank you for having me. And please call me Rachel. Even my students don't call me Professor.
It's so funny because I teach as well. And when my students call me Professor, I always look behind me as if there's somebody behind me. Exactly.
You know, I tried it for a few years. It just didn't feel right for me. You know, it's great for my colleagues.
Well, that's fine. I'm going to quickly give some statistics that I pulled from your book. The domestic violence accounts for about 15% of all violent crime. Interestingly, between 2000 and 2006, there were 3,200 American soldiers who were killed. During the same time, domestic violence claimed the lives of over 10,000. 20 people are assaulted every minute by a domestic partner. Domestic violence costs our country $8 billion a year and 8 million lost work days. It's the leading cause of homelessness. And 54% of all mass shootings involve domestic violence of some type. Rachel, let's start with that last one, because that's a grabber. That really grabs you. Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit mm-hmm. about the connection between mass murder and domestic violence.
So one of the, this is one of so many things in this book that shocked me. I mean, I felt like, I don't know if you've ever read Malcolm Gladwell, but you know, he sort of takes like whatever the general opinion is and then turns it on his head. Like, I feel like every other page of this book, I was doing that. And that stat in particular, 54% of mass shootings are domestic violence homicide. That's the language that I use in the book. I always thought that domestic violence was like a canary in the coal mine for mass shootings or like some kind of predictor. No, that's not true. 54% are mass shootings. And I'll just give you like two or three super quick examples and then you'll see what I mean. The first mass shooting in America, widely recognized mass shooting, was Charles Whitman, the University of Texas Tower.
Right.
Back in the 60s, he killed all those students. People forget that he started the night before with his wife and his mother. The Washington, D.C. had the sniper, John Muhammad, I think his name was, back in 2002. He was doing that, those planned attacks, those sniper attacks, as a way to cover up his ultimate plan, which was to kill his wife. He was terribly violent toward her throughout their marriage, and that was his ultimate goal. But there are so many others. You know, Adam Lanza started with his mother at home before he went to Newtown. I mean, you can look at so many, and even some of the ones that are not sort of, that don't loom as large in our national consciousness. Like there was a spa shooting in Wisconsin, right? Just not too far from Chicago,
right?
A few years ago, 4 people were killed. You know, that's statistically a mass shooting. And that was, again, an estranged husband stalking his wife and killed her at the spa and then killed some employees as well. And her friend, I think.
I think it's important to talk a little bit about the history of abuse and how the law has treated it and how society has treated it. Can you just briefly give us some bullet points that if you kind of put them together, and as you do in your book so well, it sort of makes you understand why this problem is such a problem and why, in my opinion, and obviously your opinion, it's not really being dealt with very well in this country?
Yeah, I mean, so there's a couple parts to that question. And I guess what I would say is, you know, for most of human history, wives have been the property of their husbands. And so there were no laws against, keeping your cattle in whatever way you wanted to keep it. And your family was an extension of that sort of property mindset as well. So that was just the way it was. It really wasn't until the mid-19th century, at least in this country, in the U.S., that it became any kind of issue of national conversation. And there were some states that passed laws against it. Interestingly enough, Mississippi was one of the earliest ones, which, you know, Mississippi now has a pretty high domestic violence homicide rate statistically. But it was not, there was no federal law against beating your spouse in the United States until, are you ready for this? This is going to like knock some of your listeners on their head. 1984.
Wow.
20 years after the civil rights movement. So we just are far beyond. I mean, you can look at that stat. You can look at that fact one of two ways. You can either look at that with horror and say, oh my God, you know, women had the right to vote before they, you know, had the right to not be beaten in their own homes. You can look at it that way, or you can look at it this way, which is the way I look at it. Wow, we've done a lot in like 35, 40 years.
We're talking to Rachel Snyder, who wrote the book, No Visible Bruises. We're talking about domestic violence. You know, this week, Cook County courts were criticized following some bail reforms, which are probably pretty good in my view as an attorney. But the problem is it's releasing these perpetrators over and over again with no bond or very small bonds. And there are several instances that were detailed in the local newspapers of these people coming out and abusing women over and over again, sometimes 5 or 6 times, threatening their lives, trying to set their house on fire because the system is not dealing with these cases. And you talk a lot in your book about how the court systems fail these women. Can you just talk a little bit about some of your criticisms with how the court systems and work in this country?
You know, it's so easy to dismiss domestic violence. I had an excerpt of this book ran last weekend in the New York Times, and it talked about, that excerpt talked about evidence-based prosecution, which is used a lot in domestic violence. I won't get into a particular court case called Crawford because it's too much in the weeds, I think, for listeners. But they used evidence-based prosecution in order to keep victims off the stand, because when victims take the stand, of course, there's retaliation, and nobody goes to domestic violence. Very, very few perpetrators go for domestic violence, to jail or prison for domestic violence for anything more than, like, you know, 30 days, 90 days. That's your typical sentence for a misdemeanor. You very rarely, if somebody gets, like, a felony assault or felony attempted murder, they may have some serious jail time. But for the most part, when you are found guilty of domestic violence, or if you plea out, you spend little to no time in prison. And part of the problem is exactly what you're saying, is that there's first of all, very often a disconnect between criminal and civil courts. So you might have someone who is arrested for a domestic disturbance, right? That misnomer, that phrase irks me so much, but a domestic disturbance, and they'll have some small misdemeanor charge. They'll end up in civil court. They may have much more significant charges in criminal court, but those courts aren't necessarily communicating with one another. The prosecutors aren't necessarily looking for other evidence, like witnesses or family members who may be willing to testify on behalf of the victim, instead of putting the victim on the stand and facing someone who, you know, she or he knows is likely to kill them next time. But there are two states, that Pennsylvania and Massachusetts. Now, Pennsylvania is new to this, but Massachusetts has been doing this for a while. They have something called a dangerousness hearing, where if somebody is deemed to be dangerous prior to trial, they can be held for up to 180 days. It's hugely controversial because, of course, some scholars say it goes against the Constitution to hold somebody before they've gone on trial. But if they're deemed dangerous enough, and some of these perpetrators that I have interviewed, or I've interviewed their victims, are, it's just shocking what they do. There's one that just stands out to me, a guy who used to throw a blanket over his wife's head and then duct tape her around the neck. I mean, it's just utterly chilling when you think about it, right? And she's a woman who is just, she's safe now, thank God, let me just say, she's safe, she's a survivor, but she would walk around. You know, there were no visible bruises
right
on her anywhere, and yet she lived with this kind of terror.
And one thing I just want to say, and we're going to have to take a break, is I've seen a slew of these lately where you've got a guy who maybe lived in another state, and he comes here, and he starts to abuse a woman or stalk a woman, a lot of stalking, and then the woman goes on social media and says, gosh, this guy's stalking me, try to get him to stop, and sure enough, there's another woman, and then there's six women who have the same thing happening, and then they find that he lived in New York, and he lived in California, and he had the same thing happening there. And nobody has a system that says, hey, this guy was a stalker in two different states, and now he's a stalker with six women in one state. Why isn't this somehow coming together so we can see how very dangerous and pervasive his actions have been when it comes to women? These women are terrorized. They're moving out of state. They're changing their names because of one guy. And it doesn't seem like the prosecutors are very interested in it, to tell you the truth.
Right. It's true. And I will say, like, you've hit the nail on the head in terms of that's how simple a solution we need, that kind of solution, to have a database that is interstate, right? So that somebody can be who has a history in California can be, you know, someone in Illinois can see that history. I mean, it's just not that complicated. We certainly have the technological know-how. And the other thing is, prosecutors are overwhelmed with some of these cases. And they see, I know in arraigning the court, they see a lot of, like, oh, well, she slapped his phone out of his hand and he slapped her phone out of her hand. And I know there's that sort of low level. That's not necessarily the kind of case I'm talking about, although that can happen in a much larger context that is missed by a prosecutor who is not trained on how to look for contexts and other evidence of domestic violence.
Rachel, we're going to have to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk again with Rachel Snyder, who is the author of No Visible Bruises About Domestic Violence. If you have a comment or question, 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. You're listening to The Karen Conti Show on WGN. Welcome back. We're talking to author Rachel Snyder, book of the much praised book, No Visible Bruises, about domestic violence. Rachel, thanks again for joining me. Now, one of the things that you did in your book, you kind of, what's nice about it is you have real life stories and you see the family and the perpetrator and how things play out. A lot of times there's not a happy ending to the stories you have, but it kind of explains the dynamic. What are the dynamics that you see in a serious abuse case, and a lot of them, like I said, not happy endings, where the woman is actually murdered at the end. What are the commonalities that you see for very serious domestic violence cases?
Coercion, severe isolation. There's a woman in my book, and I'm glad that you mentioned the stories, because I don't, I don't want people to think that it's entirely depressing. Like, it does actually have a hopeful end,
right?
But I also wrote it to kind of read like a novel. I didn't want it to be just one sort of stat after another. But the woman in the book, one of the main ones, Michelle Monson Mosier, was really isolated from her family. Her husband would say things like, I know your family just doesn't like me. It just makes me so uncomfortable to be around them. And she felt like she couldn't then spend holidays with them or spend time with them. And they only lived a mile away. It wasn't like they had to travel far. So there was isolation. He didn't let her work outside the home. He insisted that it was his duty to take care of them. So sort of very gendered roles in that home. He didn't let her have friends over. He would say it was bad for the kids to have like other influences. There was just a lot of that kind of manipulation. Not a ton of physical violence so far as anyone could tell. She filed one and only one affidavit the entire time she was with him, which was about nine or 10 years before he killed her. And in that affidavit, she said that he had beat her, but that's the only time. People never saw bruises on her. They never saw injuries on her. He did one time right before he killed her. He went up to the outskirts of Billings, Montana, where they lived, and got a rattlesnake and brought it home and kept it in a cage. And would tell her that he was going to put it in the shower with her or in bed with her while she was sleeping. She didn't obey him. So
many creative ways to be abusive.
I mean, you can't.
Yeah. One of the things that I want to talk about is you spend some time with the perpetrators, and this is not always focused on, but you spend some time in the sessions that they have in prison and the sessions that they have to try to help them so that when they get out of prison, they don't just go right back to doing the same thing, which is very typical for abusers. They don't seem to stop, in my view, from what I've seen. They just have a new victim, or they sometimes go back to the old victims if they can find them. What are the things that you saw that surprised you about dealing with the perpetrators? Do you think they can be cured? Do you think they can come to realize that what they're doing is wrong? Or are they so narcissistic and so focused, self-focused, that they can't possibly see that their actions are causing harm?
Well, I guess, I would say both are true. I mean, there are people that you're just not going to be able to rehabilitate. But one of the things that was important in this book was to disrupt so many of the stereotypes we carry. So, I talk about how women can be the abusers. I talk about how there are significant, gay and lesbian relationships where there is abuse, or, mothers are often abusive toward children, or elder abuse, right? There's all different constellations of it. And along those same lines, I wanted to be able to hear from abusers themselves. And so I sat in on the batterers intervention groups that I sat in on happened to be all men. And one of the most surprising things was when they were in these groups, they were truly in a safe place where they were able to be vulnerable. Out in the world with their buddies or whatever, they don't feel that. They feel this almost sort of unconscious, unspoken cultural incentive to adhere to whatever that kind of stereotype of masculinity is. But in these groups, they would talk about how much they miss their children, how in particular one I sat in on in jail in California. I mean, that it was just devastating to them to not be in their children's lives. But, and that is not the vision that we get.
No, but well, like, and I'm sure there's people out there, Rachel, that are saying, well, why should we care if they're missing their children? Guess whose fault that is that you're sitting in jail? You know, you had to beat up their mother, and now you're in jail, and now you're feeling sorry. What is it that you glean from this you know, this outpouring of emotion?
Yeah, I mean, I can't. Just from a personal perspective, I feel like everybody has a story, and most of these guys doesn't excuse their behavior as adults, but the overwhelming majority of them have sexual assault or physical violence in their own childhoods. So this is the cycle of violence. This is what they've been taught. This is all they know. And the group that I sat in on was fascinating because it was a year-long program, 5 days a week, 8 hours a day, batterers intervention. So this is not your typical, like, 2 hours once a week in some office kind of batterers intervention. And the educational components of this, I mean, the first thing they have to do is acknowledge their violence. Like, that's the number one thing. But one of the fascinating things I watched was called the separation cycle exercise, where one guy talks about a violent incident that he caused, and they spend hours deconstructing second by second that incident. So they teach him, or they teach each other, really, it's peer led, what his body looks like as it moves through a room towards somebody, how threatening it is, right? Their chest pump, their muscles clench, they hunch over like a bear, sort of, their voice gets loud. And for nearly all of them, it's the first time they've ever had that kind of self-awareness. Like, it blows their minds to learn what they actually look like. Another big part of this education is gender, you know, sex education, gender education. I have an 11-year-old, so sex education is in my house a lot lately. But they teach them gender education, right, and cultural norms and social expectations and how they've been kind of bred to believe that women are subservient to men. And that also blows their mind. It blows their mind to think that who they are is partly shaped by their environment and not their own, you know, their own will or their own vision of themselves. So it's true that narcissism is a huge component of abusers and perpetrators of abuse. But I believe they can change, but I believe we have to temper our expectations about how long that might take, how much we have to devote to it in terms of time and resources.
And it seems like it would be worth it if these guys are going to be getting out because, you know, like you said before, their sentences, unless they've committed murder or some really atrocious crime, they're going to go out again. And if they're not cured or at least tempered in their conduct, you know, it's going to escalate and we're going to have even more than we do now. But
well, that's the amazing thing about this program was that in the first year, it's been going on for a long, long time, but in the first year, they had researchers from NYU, a researcher named James Gilligan, and his research partner come in and do an analysis, and they found an 85% drop in recidivism with the guys in this particular unit.
Well, 85%. That's a good stat. Rachel, yeah. I'm sorry, we're going to have to just cut it off. We've got all these deadlines here, but will you come back and talk about this important topic again?
Anytime. I'm a Chicago girl. Oh. I'm there for Chicago anytime it needs me.
Okay, Rachel, well, don't come to Chicago now because it's nasty cold and bad weather, but thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, I'm going to be there next week. You've got to improve it before I get there.
I'll do what I can. Please, buy this book, No Visible Bruises by Rachel Snyder. It's an excellent account, very entertaining. It's not as sad as we've been talking about, but it's very educative on this very important issue. Thank you for joining us and happy Mother's Day to you.
Thank you for having me.
We'll take a break now. We'll come back. You're listening to WGN. Boom, shake it up. Boom, boom, shake it up. Stay. Boom, shake it up. Boom, boom, shake it up. Get ready now. Shake it up. Boom, boom, shake it up. Mother's Day. to everyone. This is the time where I'm going to be taking some legal questions from you. Anything that's on your mind about any legal topic, I'm happy to try to answer your question or steer you in the right direction. You call here at 312-981-7200. You will talk to Ben, my producer. You will tell him your story and your question as briefly as you can, and we'll get you on the air. And you can use your name or use another name if you prefer not to let everyone know who you are. That's just perfectly fine. And I can talk about various areas of law. I practice in the area of family law, but throughout my 33 years of practicing law, I've done criminal defense, insurance work, I've done employment litigation, I've done commercial business litigation, I've probably done a little personal injury. I've done pretty much everything you can possibly do as a lawyer, probably except for tax work. That's one thing I've never really done and probably never will want to ever do. But so I can kind of talk around or kind of give you some good advice in the right direction. 312-981-7200. And if for some reason you do not want to contact me here, I'm always available at the office. And I say this because I like to provide this service to WGN listeners. I do get a lot of emails and telephone calls, and I try to give people the right advice or refer them to somebody who might be able to answer their question if I can't, or send a link or send a website or give some information about organizations that can help. So the law is something that is, you know, I always say that the people who can afford it the least need it the most. And that's sort of the truth of the legal process. And so I'm, in some small way, I try to help people get in the right track. And that number, if you want to call me at the office, is 312-332-7800. You could write that down or put it in your phone, because you never know when you need a lawyer. Sometimes you don't need one, and then all of a sudden you do, or your friend does, and I'm happy to help out. 312-332-7800. But the best way to reach me so I can get back to you quickly would be an email. And that email address is wgn@askkarenconti.com. That's Ask Karen, K-A-R-E-N, Conti, C-O-N-T-I, .com. wgn@askkarenconti.com. I had Hillary emailed me this week, and she said that she is renting a vacation home out of state. I'm not going to, really tell you her. She gave me a permission to say this. I'm not using real names or real states, but she said that she was asked to sign a waiver for this home that she was going to be renting, or it was a townhouse of some type, and it was a waiver, and I read it, and the question was, should she sign it? And it basically was saying that she couldn't sue even if the owner of the building or the apartment was negligent. And generally speaking, and I'm just going to talk generally because the law is different in each and every state, but a lot of people get waivers and they don't want to sign them because they don't know what they mean. And generally speaking, you probably don't have much choice in a health club or whatever. You're not going to rewrite their waiver for them. And it's going to be what it's going to be. But generally speaking, a company can waive rights to general negligence. So let's just say that, you know, you trip and fall on something that you didn't see there. Clearly, you're waiving your right to sue them for that. But if there's some, usually the law says that if there's something very dangerous in the property that the owner was aware of or should have been aware of and didn't fix it or didn't warn you of that problem and you got hurt, then you could still sue them even if your waiver attempts to get around that. So, for instance, I would use an example. Let's just say that this was a waterfront property and there was a dock, and the owner knew that there were some loose boards out there. And let's just say your family went out there and it fell in, or you injured your leg because you fell through. Well, clearly, you can't contract away liability for things you knew about. And so in this kind of case, that waiver probably wouldn't be enforceable. And things that are they're intentional, which usually that doesn't happen, but that also cannot be waived. So generally speaking, just general plain negligence, it's you can waive, and the courts will say, yes, we want to prevent lawsuits and we want to prevent people from, you know, suing unnecessarily. But if it's something that's what we call willful and wanton, which is you knew about it, you knew it was dangerous, You knew maybe kids were going to be on the property. You knew maybe people were going to be having a few cocktails at night. And so if you didn't warn about it and there's an injury, there might be liability, and a waiver is not going to help out the owner in that situation. Let us go to Dee Dee in Geneva. Hi, Dee Dee. Well, welcome to the Karen Conti Show.
Hi, thanks. So my boss is, he's starting a new company. It will be a nonprofit and it's online, and he wants me to be on the board. And I want to know what I need to do to minimize any exposure to any, problems that could arise.
That's a good question, because I too sit on some boards, and the last thing that you want is to do something out of the goodness of your heart, right?
Uh-huh,
and then
yeah.
end up being exposed financially, and you certainly are smart to think that. There's a couple of ways that this can happen, and again, I'm not going to go into the details about what this non-for-profit is, and this is just general talk. It's not specific advice. Two things.
Right.
The non-for-profit, you actually ask the non-for-profit for an indemnification clause, which means mm-hmm. that if you got sued, they would have to pay for not only the whatever verdict there might be or settlement, but they would also have to pay for your attorney's fees, and they would have to represent you. So it's called an indemnification clause, which would say that I, non-for-profit ABC, agree to indemnify Dee Dee for any negligence or any lawsuits that might be brought as a result of her work as on the board of directors of ABC. So that's one protection that you have. But that doesn't mean people can't sue you. That doesn't stop them from suing you. You still will be sued. And if for some reason the not-for-profit doesn't have enough money to defend that, you might be in trouble, because that indemnification is not going to help you. There's also insurance for this type of thing. It's generally called directors and officers policies, and companies, usually larger companies, I'm not sure how cost prohibitive it would be for a non-for-profit of this size you're talking about, to actually take out insurance so that if you were sued, let's just say the board made a decision to get involved in something and it resulted in a lawsuit, the insurance company for the directors and officers would come in and represent you and pay any and all costs associated with defending, but also any liability, settlement, or verdict. So those are two ways that I know that you can protect yourself. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, great. Thank you.
Good luck to you, and I hope that works. And that's, you know, it's good advice for anyone out there who's doing the good work on boards, because you never know what might happen. I had a case where a woman was working for an animal shelter, and they asked her to be on the board, and for some reason the animal shelter did some things that got them sued, and everyone on the board got sued. And you know, just because you may not be liable as a board member doesn't mean that you're not going to have to defend when you have a subpoena and a sheriff come out and hand you a summons. You're going to have to defend it, and someone's going to have to defend it for you, and otherwise you will probably have a judgment against you. So those are things that you should really be careful and make sure you're protected. Give us a call here, 981-7200, 312-981-7200. It's Karen Conti. I'm taking your legal calls, or text to that same number. I'll take your texts as well, 981-7200. You're listening to WGN.
When I was a little boy,
when I was just a boy,
the devil called my name.
When I was just a boy,
I say now.
Welcome back. Happy Mother's Day. Happy Mother's Day to everybody out there. You know, I was listening to the Game of Thrones commercial, which was funny, but I was looking at this. In 2018, 3,000 American children were named after Game of Thrones characters. Can you believe that? And many more over the last few years. I mean, many, many more. And over the years, 2,500 children have been named. I'm looking at you, Jerry. I bet you know what name. What name do you think? I can't hear you. You're going to have to do it in sign language. Tyrion? No. Although some have been named Tyrion, the most popular Game of Thrones name that mothers are naming their children is Arya. Arya. And then I think second is Tyrion, I think followed by Bren, Jorah, and Sansa. But thought that was very interesting for all you Game of Thrones people. I'm taking your legal calls. The phone lines are wide open. You're going to talk to Ben, the producer, 312-981-7200. Do you have a breach of contract issue? Do you have a case? Family law is one that a lot of people have questions about. Divorce, child support, maintenance, college education expenses for your children, parenting time. Do you have a question about wills, trust, and estates? I can't get real detail on that, but you can give some general advice about that, or about lawyers in general, how legal system works, or is there a possible question regarding one of the things that you've seen in the news this week? There's been a lot of stuff that has legal ramifications to it. So please give me a call here at 981-7200, 312-981-7200. I got an email this week, and I'm not going to use his real name. I'll say his name is Henry. He said he's the father and the guardian of a disabled son. They currently live here in Illinois. He is thinking of actually moving out of Illinois across the border. And the question is, maybe the son might be moving to another state as well. Does he have to have his guardianship papers redone based upon the fact that he moves or the fact that the son moves? Again, this is not specific advice because I would have to know exactly what the facts are. But when you are a guardian for your adult son, he's basically a ward of the state. So if you move out of state, that's probably not significant enough to hire a lawyer and have it redone. It probably doesn't matter. But if you want to bring your son and move him to a different group home across the state line, you probably will have to get an order of court to do that because he is a ward of the state. So I'm not saying you would be denied. It would be something that you would just have to go to court to do. You could probably do it yourself by bringing a motion to take the child out of state. Probably easier to have a lawyer do it. And because there are ramifications to removing a child to a different state, even though the Social Security disability and some of the benefits are federal in nature, the state benefits might be different. And the ramifications of moving might have long-lasting impact on your son's financial well-being and some of the decisions that you're going to be making for him. Again, I don't know the specifics, and I don't know the differences between all of the different states, and I don't know exactly what your guardian papers say, but that's something that I think would be significant if you want to remove him from the state. And Henry, thank you so much for your nice emails. We've been emailing back and forth. Another question that I had this week from John, he sent me, he first left a message and then he sent me an email, and he was asking the question, how do I know if a lawyer is really qualified to do the type of work that he wanted them to do? So what he was asking was, do lawyers have certifications that could be checked, where I could check and see if this person is a certified estate planning lawyer or a certified personal injury lawyer? And the answer to that question is no. There really is no special certification. It's not like you go to law school and you major in family law and you come out with a degree in specialized in family law. That's just not the way it works. When you come out of law school, basically, it's kind of frightening for the consumer, because a lawyer can come out and practice law in any area that he or she wants, whether he or she has any experience at all. And good lawyers usually come up in a law firm. They've had supervision. They've had training. They train themselves. They go to seminars. They have experience. They have a mentor who helps them. That's how I became a lawyer and how I got training for many, many years before I handled things on my own, which was a great way to learn. But there are people out there who hang up a shingle if they can't get a job. And it's very frightening for the consumer, because lawyers coming out of law school may not know anything. Going back to the certification, I think, you know, there are, like, if you're a patent lawyer, that's probably the only area where you have to take a special bar. And in that field, you generally have to have a degree, I believe, in engineering, and then you take the special bar and you have to be specialized, because that type of area is a very very specialized area of law. So unfortunately for consumers, that's the certification or specialization is not something that we have. Although you can look at people's websites, and if they say they've been practicing in a particular area for 20 years, or they concentrate their practice on a certain area, that usually means that they know what they're doing and that they're experienced and they're going to do a good job for you, hopefully. Let's. Can I go to Jane in Kenosha? Hi, Jane. Hi, Jane. Welcome to WGN. Not yet. Hi, Jane. Welcome to WGN. Hello.
Hi. I wanted to ask you a question.
Sure.
My son was charged with a child predator. I think. Well, he tried to go with underage girls. He was 25.
Okay.
And he wasn't going to be charged as a felon, but he broke the rules of probation, and because he had a cell phone, he didn't commit a crime, and he can't get a job. And I'm 71, and I still have to work to help him with his bills because he can't get a job.
So is he? I'm sorry. Is he back in jail because he violated the parole?
No. It's been 8 years since he got out.
Okay, and you're looking to maybe try to expunge his record so he can get a job?
Yes.
Yeah. I'm going to put you on hold because the connection is bad. Jane, this is not good news because the facts, and again, this is Kenosha, maybe this is under Wisconsin law, I'm not licensed to practice there, but generally speaking, if someone is charged with a crime and is convicted of a crime at that age, at 25, especially a sex crime, a crime of having sex with underage children, that's going to be something that will not be expunged. And he probably is on the sex offender list. He's probably got all kinds of long-term parole obligations where he can't maybe go on the internet, he can't go near schools. It's very difficult for people who have these convictions to find jobs because nobody wants to hire somebody with those with that baggage. And so I'm sorry to say that that might be something that's going to be difficult in the future. And I don't see a legal way out of it. But thanks for the call, Jane, and good luck to you.
She'll always have her dreams despite the things this troubled world can bring. Oh, say, don't you know we love you, sweet Sadie?
Happy Mother's Day again to all you mothers and mothers who mother and fathers who mother and stepmothers and all kinds of mothers. We still have time for legal questions, 981-7200, and I'm going to give out my office number and email in case you would like to consult with me privately. The phone is always a private answering machine, and my email is private, so you don't have to worry about me disclosing it to anyone. The email address is wgn@askkarenconti.com, KarenConti. And my phone number at the office, 312-332-7800. Hopefully I can give you some advice or point you in the right direction. But tonight, the phone lines are wide open, 312-981-7200. And then we're going to do at about quarter till 9, I'm going to do a little Mother's Day quiz. And I'll take the third caller who wants to play the quiz for very valuable prizes. And I say that very facetiously. In the meantime, we're going to be taking calls 981-7200. I got a text from Kelly in Winnetka. She says, my husband and I are in litigation over some very expensive home construction work. My lawyers, who are experienced in this area, send me bills for legal research that they perform. They also charge an hourly rate for Westlaw. She says that in quotes. What is this? And shouldn't lawyers already know the area of law when you hire someone in this field? Should I have to pay these charges? They are substantial. That's a really good question. And I know this sounds strange to people because you're right. You hire a lawyer, say in family law or construction law or probate litigation or whatever the area is, and you think, well, why are they doing research? Don't they know the law? What am I paying someone to go to school? And that's really not the way to look at it. Generally speaking, a lot in the law gets decided in writing, meaning you see the Perry Mason shows and all the shows where it's about oral argument and making an argument before the court. And that does happen. But what you have in a lot of cases in federal court, in substantially in federal court, is that most of the motions are decided based upon the written word. So your briefs, your motions, your petitions, whatever you put in writing, the court will really, really rely very heavily on what is in that brief. And in so doing, you have to be persuasive. And the way that we lawyers are persuasive is we cite to cases that are precedent, meaning this is something that's been decided before, and these are cases that were decided by judges just like you in Illinois, and judge, you must follow it because you can't deviate from something that's already been established by prior decision. And so what you try to do, whether the issue is a construction issue or whether it's a procedural issue or whether, you know, it's a kind of a, you know, a lot of them are very procedural in nature. So you want to find one that fits your fact pattern. And just because you know the area of law doesn't mean that you know every single case that's been decided that would help persuade the court. So lawyers don't generally do research they don't need to do. And it takes time to do research. But now we have a couple of different programs that we can use. And we've had them for 30, 40 years. But they're pretty good now. Westlaw is one of them. LexisNexis is another one. It has a lot of data on it, other than case precedent. But it's a way that lawyers can do it without going to the books. And it makes it a lot faster. And you have keyword searches, like sort of like Googling, that can help you find the cases that are going to be most persuasive. So I think that what you should do with your lawyer is look at the bill. And if you feel like it's a lot of money and that you know, that seems like something that you don't want to pay for, that seems out of proportion to what is going on, ask the lawyer, why did you have to research this? What were you doing? When I do legal research, I'll say legal research in anticipation of oral argument or legal research for case precedent on the issue of child support for an adult disabled child in anticipation of drafting motion for whatever. So I'm telling you why I'm doing it, and I'm putting in there what the written product is. So I think that's very important for you to understand it, but it's a normal part of being a lawyer. But thank you, Kelly, for that. I'm going to give out the numbers again. I'm looking for the third caller who is going to play my trivia game. Please give me a call. Valuable prizes at stake, 312-981-7200. And mothers will get priority, but fathers can call in too. 981-7200. We'll play the little trivia game. Let's see. There, Sandra from Oak Park sent me an email this week saying, my daughter is dating a guy that I do not like. He has been married twice before, and I think he has financial issues and is not being truthful with my daughter about his past. What things can I do legally to find out about this guy, preferably without anyone knowing? Well, you can do background checks. You know, some of the background checks that employers do, you don't have access to that because you can't do that. But you can always hire a private investigator. I have a couple of private investigators I work with. And if you have their name and some relevant information, they can run a search and they can find out about aliases. They can find out about various addresses, perhaps bankruptcies. Do they own a car? Do they have foreclosures? Those types of things. And you can also go to the courthouse if the person was married before. You can actually go to their divorce file. Divorce files are a public record. So let's say if he was divorced 10 years ago, you might want to call the court and you might have to order the file to be taken from the archives and brought to the courthouse. And then you find a date and time and you go up there and you can look through and you can find out what his finances were. You can look and find out what the arguments were. Were there allegations of abuse? Were there children? And you can find out quite a bit from a divorce file, which is really news for people. People don't understand that when they are litigating in their divorces and they're saying ugly things and saying bad things and fighting like crazy, that stuff is available someday for someone to see. And soon enough, all of the stuff will be online so that all the person needs to do is Google it and find some very personal and private information. So word to the wise, make sure when you are litigating that you're not saying things that your grandchildren are going to be reading down the line. So by the way, there's some dating detective services. There's one called ASTE, E-A-S-T-E. I'm not vouching for its how good it is, but for a very small amount of money, you can have them do some searches to find some things if it's a dating situation. I really highly recommend that people who are on dating websites do a little bit of research, because I think the statistics are that 12% of people who are married, 12% of the people online are married who are saying that they're not married. And over 50%, I think the issue is like 53% on dating services, are lying about something significant. So, you know, before you get involved or before one of your loved ones gets involved, I don't think it's really a bad thing to do a little due diligence. Go to the court file if there's a divorce, run the name through at least a Google search, right? And if not, call me. I have a private investigator who can do a background search and maybe get some information that might help you. Let's take a break now. When we come back, I think we have a contestant, and we're going to do the Mother's Day quiz on the Karen Conti Show on WGN.
Oh, mama, like the roses, she'd grow them in the yard. But winter always came around and made the growing way too hard.
It's kind of a sad Mother's Day song. But it's Elvis, so. Anyway, happy Mother's Day. We're going to play a little Mother's Day trivia, and we have Janet from Downers Grove. Hi, Janet.
Hello.
Are you a mother?
Yes, I am, of three.
Well, happy Mother's Day, and
thank you.
We're going to say that if you get five right, you win a very valuable prize that you'll get to pick. Are you ready?
Okay.
All right. What percentage of laundry is done by mothers in the United States? A, 48%, B, 52%, C, 65%, or D, 88%? What percentage of laundry is done by mothers?
88%.
That is correct. You have one correct.
Okay.
That's right. That's probably easy to understand. Why is it, though? Why? You know what? Dads can do it. They can throw it in there and fold just as well. But anyway.
That's right.
That's right. Okay, true or false? Mothers take an average of 2 minutes and 5 seconds to change a diaper. Fathers take 1 minute and 36 seconds to change a diaper. True or false?
I would say false.
That is true. Mothers take substantially longer to change diapers. Now, I don't know. What is there a reason that you think that would happen?
I don't know, because women are usually, you know, pretty efficient and quick about those things. They
exactly.
Got to get on to the next. They got to get on to do that laundry.
Yes, that's right. They've got to be multitasking. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
The dryer's buzzing. You got to go. All right. What mother animal nurses their baby for the longest time? A, a human. B, an elephant. C, an orangutan. Or D, a hippopotamus. What mother animal nurses their baby, and I'm calling humans animals, nurses their baby for the longest time? Human, elephant, orangutan, or hippopotamus?
Oh, well, I'll say elephant.
You know, it's an orangutan. And orangutans nurse for 6 or 7 years.
Oh, my gosh.
Isn't that funny? Okay.
I think elephants are like 5 years. They're
long.
Yeah,
I think they're long, too. You're right.
Okay, well.
This is one that's a little bit disgusting. Okay. A mother koala bear will feed her baby, A, her own feces, B, tree bark, C, regurgitated eucalyptus leaves, or D, live worms. Mother koala bear, the cutest animal in the world.
Would you say the answers again?
Her own feces, tree bark, regurgitated eucalyptus leaves, or live worms?
I'll say her own feces.
That is correct. Koala bears, actually, the babies cannot eat the eucalyptus leaves because it's poison to them, and they have to develop some sort of stomach enzyme or the like. So that's very good. You've got two.
Oh, my gosh.
All right. Who is the first sitting senator, U.S. senator, to give birth while in office? Carol Moseley Braun, Tammy Duckworth, Barbara Boxer, or Dianne Feinstein?
I think it's Tammy Duckworth.
That's correct. She just gave birth in April at age 50, and she was the first sitting senator to give birth while in office.
Okay.
All right. You got three. It's going well. This person did not have a baby this week. Royal Meghan Markle, Kim Kardashian, Beyonce, or Amy Schumer?
Beyonce.
That is correct. We had Royal Meghan Markle, Archie. Kim mm-hmm. Kardashian had a child, and we don't know what the name is. I think we have North and Saint in Chicago, so who knows what name it will be.
Right.
And comedian Amy Schumer had a baby named Jean, which is a very normal name. All right.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the Game of Thrones, how do you say it's Daenerys, right? Daenerys is a mother, but not to humans. What creature is she a mother to? Daenerys in Game of Thrones is a mother, but not to human beings. What creature is she a mother to?
Oh, I don't watch Game of Thrones.
Well, just think of the, some of the creatures that you see in the
game. Okay, so maybe the dragon.
Yes, that's correct. She had, I believe, three dragons, right? She had three eggs and three dragons, and I think there's one left as of tonight. Great. All right.
Okay.
Who is the celebrity mother of actress Carrie Fisher? Doris Day, Elizabeth Taylor, Debbie Reynolds, or Connie Stevens?
Debbie Reynolds.
That is correct. You're way over the five mark, but we're going to give another celebrity question. Who is the daughter of Judy Garland? Bette Midler, Edie Gourmet, Liza Minnelli, or Pia Zadora?
Liza Minnelli.
That is correct. You have done a great job, Janet. You are the winner. We have a Karen Conti Law Legal Pad. We have a book on domestic violence, or we have a Karen Conti hat. You get your choice.
Well, I will take your legal pad. I listen to you every Sunday.
Okay, that sounds great. Thank you, and a happy Mother's Day to you, and thanks for playing, Janet. Take care.